I'm Herb.
And you're Jack, right?
Right.
All right, we've got that straight. I'll keep that in mind because you're my left, and that's Jack, I'm Herb. That's spatial, that's probably not too important, but I can recall, it just came to my mind. People sometimes say, did you prepare for that? And I said, yes, I went to St. Louis once and saw it. And it came to my mind, so I prepared. It was a long trip, and I stayed a whole day, and I saw what I'm going to say. That just came to my mind. Are you ready to talk about it? I say, yes, I think I am. How would I get ready? By writing it down the day before? Does that make me more ready? I'm talking about spatially, namely where one takes notes and then writes off those notes or writes off that agenda. And what do you do with the agenda that comes to your mind that informs you of some very marvelous places where you've been? And to give that place, that stuff, space in your talk means that you have to cut into your agenda. That's called improv. Sometimes that's called an interruption. That's called moving out of your margin into the center. And sometimes when we don't allow that, those things no more come, don't come anymore. And so all those marvelous places that come off the gut don't come in anymore. And we probably say exactly what we plan to say. And I don't. I don't think you do either, but there are those, you know, there are so many places one can go to when one says one word. That's often called free association. You know, one can go just any direction. I don't know if it's east, west, north, south, northwest, or what direction, but one can go out and come back. And so I am going out to St. Louis, Missouri, and there I... There I saw something that I thought of when I hit that. I saw a round table. It had a little space in it, and there was one person helping eight eat. And that what the eight didn't know was what was their own space. They were very disabled, and they were eating each other's sandwiches. It wasn't that they didn't know that this is my area or this is your area and this is your area. They had not learned that. They were grabbing right and left and eating, and the quickest got the most. And they went to school to eat. And that's what they were in this place for. And that came to my mind how marvelous it is to know if you're on the left or the right. And to know that this is where I am and this is where Jack was. I thought when I said that, how dumb. You should have started eloquently. I said, you can't sit here thinking you're a dummy the first 2 minutes. What can redeem you? And I thought, aha, a footnote. What's footnote comes to your mind? St. Louis, Missouri came to my mind. We all do that. That's called sort of thinking highly or thinking well of oneself. In other words, dealing with those things that do put one down to bring oneself back up and together. I saw people who met three times a day to discover the place called my eating place, her eating place, his eating place, and it created a marvelous fellowship. And when they could do that, they went back home. I was terribly moved by that. I was so moved I remembered it. I don't think that what we're into tonight is at all new. It's something that is very important, and contractors do it, and builders do it. They create space. Clergy do it. It's usually an hour worth of space. Some of it's toward the people, away from the people, and seminarians do it in terms of how much space is spent at a certain desk, or how much space is spent out someplace having a festival, or how much space, how much time they use with space. But space is very important. I guess anything is spatial, just anything. I was thinking, sitting here, Jack, I was thinking of the Agnus Dei. Spatially, I suppose it's usually on page 16 through 18. But that's one way to think of it. And some people, when they want to know where the Agnus Dei is, they think front of hymnal, wonder where, hope I get it in time, so that they're not one-fourth past me. That's all spatial and temporal. Those are very close together. Well, I was thinking of Mary?
Yes,
yesterday I was thinking about what we were doing. I was meeting you without touching you. Yes. And I was thinking that I was not only thinking of your blood and your colored eyes, I was thinking of your whole life. And while I was thinking of that, I was thinking of Abraham going up the hill to take his son, not just, to give his whole son up. And I was thinking, while I was looking at you and thinking of all the history and all the people you have influenced, all those, and taking it and, you know, putting it there as an offering into that big envelope on Moriah, that great big paper envelope with a little wood under it and fire, that one, that huge offering. And then I was thinking how later it was the whole lamb, not and a pet lamb, one they loved, they gave up. It's called life, called blood. But blood, sometimes people think, is that stuff, you know, in the veins. But it was to give up one's Mary. And then it was to give up one's son, the Lamb of God. And now the Honest Day really is not on page 16, but it's here. And that's toughy for me. You know, how does one turn to the other? And when does one? And when does one not? And when does one have an Honest Day? And where are you? And what is this space? When, you know, when Dale says, can you handle it without saying anything? Honest days can even be memorized, they can even be harmonized, but what does one do with this? I remember this, and I remember St. Louis. I remember being with you, and I remember being there. And I want to read a poem. I don't know if it's a poem. It's what I saw when I looked into a picture of one of these. This is an object. A picture is an abstract of this. It's an image of this object. If I came in with a picture, that would not be so bad, called Bird's Nest. If I wrote it on the blackboard, some people would like that better. Because what are you doing with a picture when you can write the word, they might say? That's an abstraction of the image. If I came with a bird's nest, they would wonder. I do. I often come with a bird's nest because this is not as abstract as the word bird's nest. And I don't need the blackboard now because I have a bird's nest. I didn't go out and pluck it. I found it here. It's been around. This would be nice.
Play Bird's Nest?
Yeah. So, I could have asked you to hum it. I'm going to ask Jack to play it. Play it like a, just a... Temporary housing. Transient. Shut down for a season. Back to the south. Back to the city. On to the next place. Shut down for a season, for two seasons. Back to the state for back taxes, vacant. For sale, for rent, tax sale. Gone without warning, the transient. Without anyone to tell, moving vans, loading at night, trikes and trunks and dilapidated treasures wrapped hastily by strangers and carried swiftly at top speed down highways away somewhere. The post office knows in the files of the business office, and the loud room is silent, heaters turned off, lights disconnected, for sale, for rent, for taxes, to be remodeled by a retired handyman. Herman, here it is, to be used as is by the poor, to be raised by a wrecking crew, to be preserved by a subcommittee in a society, to be dug out for the sake of a multi-million dollar dwelling place for 200 transient families who come in the night and go in the night ahead of a van for the sake of the corporation. Anonymous flights of Jacobs, known if possible only to the company's cashier, no longer one but 200 now in need of borrowing and loaning. May I have 3 eggs and a half cup of sugar, please? A place will get you in the mood. A place will help you kind of put it together. That old Bible verse called "Put It Together." It's one of those that probably should have been a Bible verse. Put it together. That's nice. Do that. I got a story to tell through that. The story could become a poem. Where did the covenant between God and Abraham take place? Roland Bainton says, right where the blood worship was, there. Where in that tribe where Abraham lived, it was the rule that a son should die. And they cast lots, and now it was Abraham's boy who would die. And in that bit of blasphemy, Bainton says, in that blasphemy, inside there God goes and he says, Abraham, let's go. I'll go with the dice. And up Moriah through that thing. And then God says, Abraham, I'm going to get rid of this. Not your son, a lamb. And it says later, Abraham moved. Bainton says that Luther said, if Abraham had come down the hill without Isaac, Sarah would never have let him in the house. Can you imagine what Sarah would have done? But he came down with him, and now he had to face a city. And the covenant came right at that point where Abraham and Isaac went into a piece of history that they did every year called worshiping God by bleeding a son. Space is very important. Can you imagine just hanging up, getting out a, that would have been a nice thing in the days of Passover, to get out a lamb, just a lamb calendar, so you wouldn't have to do it. You could just take a picture. Just flip it. But no, it's a lamb. And once in a seminary, once, not in the one you are, Jim, I took a picture of Holy Communion and gave it instead of the bread and the wine. They threw it at me. I was glad. There was a little fight. They didn't like it. But I really wanted once for them to come for the bread like the hungry. How do you do that when you got enough? How do you do that when you have so much that you're burping on your way to the altar, you know? And I gave them the picture and they said, no. Give us the bread. Give us the drink. It's the only time I've ever seen people scramble. And where was the space? Instead of the bread, a photo. And they said no. Bird nest outside St. Louis. Here, Abraham's tight hold on his son. The way you were holding this, right? A tight hold. And the man, John, hugging the post last night in the session. That's all spatial, isn't it? And how do you think spatially, if you were to choreograph, if you were to imagine shapes of reconciliation or grace, how would you shape it? If this air was, let's pretend this air is like snow, or you could form it. One way to do this now is to close your eyes, because that way, there's no way in which your eyes could tell you that how your neighbor is doing. But create a shape for the word grace, okay? And close your eyes so you don't borrow too much. And let your definition come from inside. But shape grace. Now just change it a little so you don't get the impression that that's the only way you could have done it, and you feel guilty about having done it this way. Change it a little. Make another shape of grace. In speech, that would be called inflection. Create a scene called meeting. Two persons truly meeting. Do that one. Create with your two hands, the palm of your hands or so, create the shape for leaving, someone leaving. Get those hands out like pieces of sculpture. Do this like just pieces of wood, metal, marble, clay. Get them out there and then freeze them. Just hold them and have a little public look around. Just see some out there and see this nice, see the differences. Could you talk about yours? Could you say a word about it?
Not leaving.
Yes, that. Yes, she could. Could you say one? Could you speak about your word? This is your word. In what form is this word now?
In the gesture
form. If you don't know it, make it up. This is, make up a word. This is in the, what, how do you like yours?
Torn and pulled.
You're naming yours. You're titling it already. Got the bottom line that's called now. Yes. How do you like yours?
I like it.
Do you like it?
Yeah.
Why do you like it?
Because I know what it means to me.
Wow. These authors, you know, you recognize yours?
Yes, they'll probably never meet again. I
took care of that with a bend of the finger. I got one coming back. I got very lonesome, so I bent my finger in there. Yes. Okay. Oh, we got this poet at the piano. Isn't he marvelous? Yeah. Head this way soon, Jack. And Jack, while you're hunting, I want to read out of books that don't exist anymore. I can't buy them anymore. Here's a good book. It's going very well. I wrote it. It's called Eye Opener. I don't know if there are any more over there. The best one I wrote isn't selling. It's called Holy Holy. Probably because it doesn't entertain people as much as helps them to do it. But I'll read from three books that you can't get anymore, and one is called In the Rustling Grass. And Sister Noemi took the photos, and these are marvelous shapes. I never had a course in shapes, never had a course in space, but I think of it all the time. I love shapes, all kinds, and spaces, and I looked at this these frozen forms, just so locked in. If you went along and if you tried to just move that a little, what would happen?
Try to move forward.
Yes. And what would happen if you picked it, if this was real life? Yes, and this is winter. That's what this is. What would happen? What do you think would happen?
I think you'd have a seasonal change.
you'd have a seasonal change. I think you'd have a broken reed, too. Would it break?
Yes,
it would break. That's what I look at. I look at this and say, what? If I was there, it takes me on like, what would it do? It's so brittle. If I wanted to move that over and I could, I'd have to wait till spring, and it's right, I'd have a new season. I would have a new season, but I'd have to wait till spring. So if I would want to write to this as though it was spring, I'd write for waiting. Because I want this picture. I want to be there, and I look at this and I say, it's cold, it's frozen. And I can say, my goodness, how can this be the crucifixion? And I write until I'm convinced. I write until somehow I can feel the cold body. I can feel the chill of the hill. I can feel that this water is now cold and that everything that was green is brittle. And so those are the words that get to me, the words that this is. And so I get on location. I just get right into it. I let it all get around me, and I say, in the water they stood erect and courageous until they could not. And by the, so I precede this a little, and by the blast of the north wind they were bowed to the water and held there, bent down. I'm talking about the three on the hill, frozen like winter bones. The surface of Calvary was as still and solid cold as frozen lakes in the midst of a hard winter. One nail held his feet to his hands, and he stayed there tight until they loosed him and took him down. So it was also with the two crucified on either side. They were at the mercy of the people, and because of Jesus, under the mercy of the Father. And when I wrote that, at the mercy of the people, and then I get under the mercy of the Father. When you have nature and events and objects and bird nests and bread broken and wine poured and cafes and cars and spring, it's hard not to say something. And that's one way for me to share with you something that's true for all of us, and that it's good to be somewhere. It's important to know where you are, and it's good to speak out of it, and to pray out of it, and to ask out of it. And when you're there, your context is very alive, and your text is very often much in tune with the context. And you're more verbal, maybe less. Your timing fits the space. There's a wholeness and a holiness. And you come back to the rock. You come back to the nest. You come back to the picture. You come back to the page, you come back to the person, you come back to the word. Yeah. Jack.
Want me to read?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. When Herb and I were decided to do this together, I think the title is Space and Place with Poets. And we're different kinds of poets. And I'm always fascinated by the things Herb sees in space and ideas of space. And I guess for me, place is maybe more important than space, just because I'm not used to thinking in terms of space like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes a ball game, and that's what makes this session, because I think I'll read a couple of poems that the place of which has fascinated me. A lot of my poems' place is in Nebraska. Anybody from Nebraska in here?
Yeah.
I forgot. Funny thing.
I didn't plan that, really. I mean, nobody else is?
Well, I'm not either, so it's all right. But I lived in Nebraska for 2 or 3 years off and on, mostly off, and got to love it, and lived in southeastern Nebraska in a little town called Seward, which is about 30 miles from Lincoln. And I went to school at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln for a while. And got to know that the place, and I guess space, between Seward and Lincoln, 25 or 30 miles apart, and you could go on I-80, which I guess runs all the way from San Francisco to New York, but my I-80 was just from Seward to Lincoln, but I didn't go on I-80 very much. Usually it was on 34, a little country road that meandered among the hills, and that was my place. And on Friday night, most of those towns there are bohemian people with names like Selichki and Blazak Kula, and beautiful bohemian names. And the street signs would say Wilbur, Nebraska, 99% Czech. And they would have Czech festivals every year in Wilbur. And on Friday nights, you would go out into the country and eat fish and drink beer at little saloons. In fact, that's where I first saw, having been back there a while, and you kind of lose track, you almost lose track of time. You think you've gone to another world. I was out at Eleanor and Murph's Tavern in B, Nebraska, at population 37. And we were having fish and beer, and the color TV was up in the corner. And for 40 cents, we got a paper plate with three big pieces of fish. I remember one piece of unbuttered brown bread and two slices of pickle for 40 cents. And it's since gone up to 65 cents, and the 37 people are outraged. And have a schooner of beer and that fish and bread, and we were munching away and happened to look up at the color TV, and there was the first landing on the moon. And Neil Armstrong coming down and saying those fantastic words. And next to our table was four farmers playing pinochle with bib overalls and their train caps, and they were drinking wine and beer boiler makers, which must have been a bee phenomenon. I've never seen that before or since. And they were slapping the cards down, and they were from B, Nebraska. That was their place. And they stopped as Neil Armstrong sat down. They looked up and they said, "Do you believe that?" And the guy says, "Hell no." And he said, "Right back." Totally ignored it. For them, it was not happening. That must be science fiction movie. And the rest of us in the place were awestruck, but not these four guys. They really had it together, and it was their pinochle game. And I remember there was a volunteer fire department in town, and they would come in, rushing in, and grab a quick beer and maybe some fish, and they would talk about whose place burned down, and on and on. They would go out, and they would leave, and some other people would come in. And that was a great place to be in. It was very dark with an old moose head sticking out. Somebody had jammed a copy of the Seward paper in his mouth and had a little derby on one horn and softball tomorrow at Beaver Crossing signs up there and old bottles. And very dark and dismal, but a great place. And, you know, I'm from Thousand Oaks, California, and there's nothing like Eleanor and Murph's Tavern anywhere near Thousand Oaks, California. They would condemn it if it existed, and yet that was the greatest place for me. And another time we were in there having fish, and it sounds like all I did when I was in Seward was drink beer, and I did a lot of it. And Sonny and Cher show was on. This is when they were, you know, before the split and all that kind of stuff. And I went to high school with Sonny, and I looked up there and a mouthful of fish, and I saw him up there making all that money and having all this wild time. And here I was in B, Nebraska, in this little bitty dismal place. I thought, wow,
One of us has gone wrong somewhere, Sonny. I wasn't sure who it was. Neither of us, I suppose, because we both have pretty much what we want, I think. But anyway, that was my place. And I thought I'd read a poem about that area, which I love very much, even though I live in Southern California now. And I like that, too. I grew up in Southern California, really, and was a scuba diver for 15 years from Santa Barbara to Mexico, and have dived among sharks and whales and octopus and you name it. And still, my poems go back to Seward, Nebraska, and that little stretch of highway, 25 miles. I can't seem to get that out of my blood, for as I might. I don't try now. I feel very, very at home to you. Now, this is a poem. It's called "I Have a Thing to Tell You," from Seward County. And it's about, well, what it is, it's a sonnet that got away from me. I was trying to write a sonnet one day, and it's very difficult to do that, at least for me, and I have a hard time. And I had in mind a man named Frank Selitsky, a farmer whose name I'd seen out there on the mailbox while driving in the Bohemian Alps, it's called, in that part of southeastern Nebraska. And I could think of this boy coming back to the farm, having been to college for the first year, and he can't wait to get back to his uncle's farm to really set him straight on life, because he probably had one philosophy course and maybe introduction to God knows what kinds of world problems or freshman English or some silly thing. Anyway, the sonnet got away from me and it kept expanding until finally I just let it go, and it came out a different kind of a poem called "I Have a Thing to Tell You" from Seward County. Frank Selitsky scratched away the dirt and figured a while yet before they're ripe. Leaning on his hoe, he nursed the hurt out of his back and straightened as a pipe that carries smoke from family stoves is bent just so to keep it all intact. He turned to smile. His nephew, after all, went a ways around to visit, and he'd learned some things to say before the term began. Old Frank listened, saw the knitted brows, the dancing hands, and noticed how they ran along the fence, which held some freshening cows that Frank had hoped would not be dry till spring. Or then the shoats would have to sell, a thing that caused a line to deepen on his face. And nephew, seeing light, began to race. And as he talked, the other took the measure of the wheat, a simple field that gave him pleasure. The greening stand of corn, it grew, he thought, as word on word was called to add its weight. Old Frank just smiled while chewing gum he'd bought Friday night in town. His boar and mate had sold at auction in the square. Frank sniffed the rising breeze and saw the mouth, and noticed in the trees the movement where tomorrow's rain would fall. He judged from south of Lincoln near the line. The nephew gazed past mottled skies and searched his mind for golden thoughts to press the issue. Dazed by truth, he pressed his hand to eyes, blind to winging geese three on three above, and closing tight his eyes, he said, "Take love. A winter moon is white," Frank mused in bed. "I have a thing to tell you," he had said. That's a sense of place for me. Frank Selitsky's farm, the nephew who has obviously gone back to school, has graduated probably third in his class, and is now teaching in some Lutheran school deep in the bowels of Nebraska. That's a sense of place for me.
Frank Selitsky's farm, the nephew who has obviously gone back to school, has graduated probably third in his class, and is now teaching in some Lutheran school deep in the bowels of Nebraska. And by now has had one or two kids or other kinds of responsibilities. The uncle, no doubt, is long gone and left the farm to the kid. And now the kid, if he's worth his salt, is going out there on weekends and keeping it from being run down and planting some gardens. And if he's lucky, he'll look up once in a while and see the geese going south and watching the corn grow. And if he's really lucky, he'll forget about half of what he learned in his philosophy and English classes and really begin to live. I didn't mean that as a sermon. I don't know where that came from. It just kind of popped out. Well, one more. This is called I-80, and I just mentioned I-80. And that's the one that runs, as I said, and it's not in my book. Excuse me while I find it. We always took I-80, and we'd get bored trying to get from Los Angeles to Nebraska, so we'd find different ways to go. And one time we said, let's just go north a long ways and turn right and see if we can't get. So we did. We went all the way to Seattle and island to Vashon Island. I was pleased to hear Brother Preeb with his Vashon Island letter the other day. And we turned right and went through Idaho and Montana and dropped down into the Tetons and over Wyoming, and we did get to Nebraska that way. It took a little longer, but I knew it wasn't going to go away, so it was all right if we let it stay a while. And sure enough, it was still there. But anyway, I-80 is a typical, well, freeway. You know what freeways are like. Interstate, and I like truck stops and little things like that. And when we traveled in an old Ford with three bicycles up on top. We had a station wagon. We had two dogs with us, and crazy trip, and three kids piled in the back. We forgot one kid one time in Las Vegas. Talk about sense of place. We'd come through Las Vegas, going up through Heber Valley in Utah, and over that way. We tried them all. And James, we stopped at a gas station, and we gave him, I said, 5 minutes, do your thing. Tim, take the dogs out. Don't let them bite anybody this time. And on and on. And my wife is sitting there sweating and dazed, eyes rolling in the back of her head, because every time we stopped, she just kind of went crazy because she knew it was going to be a circus. And the dogs would bite someone. But we finally got them all back in the car and took off. And you know how the freeway in Las Vegas, I don't know if it's through now, but before you had to get off and crawl through Las Vegas. You just couldn't skirt it all. And we were a few miles down, kind of looking on the right and left at the casinos, and suddenly Becky in the back says, James is not here. And I hit the brake. Because James was always there. And I thought it was kind of quiet this time. And I stopped, and I looked in the rearview mirror, and the dogs had come over on top of Becky and Tim, I looked in the back and seen where they had chewed open one sleeping bag and the stuff of one, and James was not there. And we looked at each other, and Dolores went like this and kind of smiled. And I smiled, and I said, no, let's go back for him. Which we did. And luckily, we remembered which gas station. It was about 5 miles. And I thought, oh, we're going to catch it, boy, from old James. And we drove, and it was a divided highway, so we had to drive by. And he saw us going the other way. And he put his hands on his hip, you know. Anyway, we finally got to Nebraska via these kinds of things. And once in Utah, the car blew up, boiled over. One of the dogs tried to get out at a cat he saw, and Tim rolled up the window and caught the dog by the stomach. The dog was half in and half out. And this car was boiling over and making all kinds of obscene noises. And the other dog defecated all over the sleeping bag in the back. Just got car sick and just let her go. And Dolores did faint. She absolutely passed out. So that's the kind of place that I have memories of. So we got to Nebraska, and got in her house in Seward, which is a three-story frame country house, and we didn't bring anything but the TV and no furniture. And we went out to auctions and garage sales, and for $139 bought enough stuff for the house. And we found what Thoreau learned a long time ago, how little you really need to live. And, of course, then after that year, we come back and we start gathering all our possessions about us. I'm like, God, how could we do without this? And we need six of those, and naturally this garage has to be this big. But for that year, I didn't miss anything. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine loaned me an old couch that the guts kept coming out, and every Saturday we'd turn it over, and Dolores would stuff a cat or some rags in it and pack it down so it wouldn't bulge. Anyway, on Interstate 80, to get to the poem, which ran... It was a little cutoff near Milford and Seward, and there was a little plaque there. It was a prehistoric Indian site. And when you got tired of going down to the lot behind the post office where they took all the wrecked cars and wondering about the ghastly accidents, which is all there was to do in Seward, to go every Sunday, the people walk down there and say, look at that car. He never made it. And they had all a conversation like that. Or you go to Rolfsmeyer's for ice cream. And after we'd had enough of that, then we would go out to I-80 and get off on the off-ramp and watch all the people from, you know, going east and west. And it led to the poem, right? I-80 runs along the Blue River, and the hot station wagons boil over beneath the diseased elms that bear the red X. Next year we're promised pin oaks, croons the elderly lady, passing out brochures. The river is green from the trees, green and thick and slow-moving between the muddy banks. The plaque reads, prehistoric Indian site. God, all they got in Nebraska is dead Indians, says a man in shorts with black dress shoes and long black socks. Skeeters slap whack with a brochure on rednecks. Hell, let them keep the place. And off on I-80, heading east to education or west to retirement, leaving the blue sluggish in its banks and the Oto bones quiet beneath the green hillock. Back to you, Herb.
Oh, all right. Do you play drums and all? could you scuba dive in a moment?
Yes.
I don't know whether we agree on this. I think that when three of us go to ring a bell not far from Northfield at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we're in that place on that hill and saying something to the idea of keeping that building open and alive in that community, that's being poet, I think. I don't think that all poets get published, all that's poetry gets printed. When we at Holden a few years ago wanted to call one day by one name, we called it something like Day of Renewal or Reclamation. And it was when the river sauna was being built, and there were leftover logs. And in the front of the altar, you see Mary and Joseph and the child. They are out of those remnants. They are part of that whole day's celebration, where people went out and looked twice at something that they hadn't seen once. And by looking twice, that became a third thing, and they carried it into the village. And that night, we had a great festival, where we had symbols in some physical form. We also had symbols in verbal form. We also had symbols in experiential form, and all three forms. We had something that we could carry, hold a while, auction off, raise a lot of money later in the week, and those three are still from that day. We looked twice at spaces, logs, leftovers, piles of things. I think that was being poetic that day. I think that was being poet. Or one day, John, when you welded this, because we wanted for children to see, and they lay their heads in this, and they saw different shapes and triangles and circles, and some of them were looking up into the sky for the first time, and by blocking out little triangles, we turned their faces up again. And that is standing outside there on the pole. But the first time it came into the village, it set right here. And we named it. That was being poet that day, and it won't all get printed. Not all poetry gets printed. I think that's what poetry is too, and that's when we are the poet. When we have just one way or one shout to say how we feel, I think that's a magnificent poem. It's too bad it couldn't get printed and you couldn't earn the rest of your life on it, but that's a poetic look. I mean, poetry, surely not just a few people do it. Or just one more example, when someone who had lived in the mountains and in this village for a long time, and wanted one night to do Vespers, and an artist, a poet kind of person, went up there and welded for Pentecost service that night a cage, and brought the cage down, put the cage on the stage where the curtain is now drawn, and put the stage there. Instead of having acolytes, we had water lights, and we had buckets of water there, and we had a shield, because this person, a welder, a sculptor in this village, felt that what he needed somehow to say, even if he could not do it, was, how can I get out of this my own creativity box? He had virtually elaborated himself into a configuration, and he got into this thing. And the liturgy that night was, I'm coming out, and he took the torch and he cut. And I said, why don't you cut? If you cut here and cut here, it would only be two and it would drop. He said, I'm coming out the hard way, and he cut, and they were throwing water, and he was cutting, and there was sizzling, and the people were watching it against the board, and it was bright, and and there was a drum roll, and it was a great poetic night for a man, I don't think, who ever wrote a poem in his life, but that night, he, like a prophet, walked into this town and said, there's something I wish very much, and that is to get out. And it was a very clear statement, and we could all read that piece of poem, and it was for the pre-readers and the post-readers. It was poetry. And that's kind of what I want to say also, and that is that there aren't three or four people, I think, who own, you know, being the poets, and that there are all kinds of ways of expressing that. I'd like to read one poem, and then it's to you, Jack, and we'll wind it up whenever you wish and however you wish. What I liked about this book, City and Country, and I liked it a whole lot better than the people who didn't buy it, was that it was country photos and city poems, and I liked that. I don't worry too much because three of them are now in cantatas. I don't worry. Once, when I was very ill, I just took this book, and when I thought I couldn't stand the pain, I transformed three of these into a cantata, and they are now being sung, so that I won't let go. But this is a marvelous poem on gossiping, where the trees and the branches touch each other. So you've got some main streets and some tiny alleys, and when you look at this, it would make a perfect outline for a layout of a city. It would be as good as any. Perhaps you wouldn't need stop signs in this one because of how it's constructed. Nature gives us marvelous configurations for how to see something and how to say something and how to visualize something, even how to build something. And we know that. We know that nature gives us all kinds of ways by which even to think again about theology. It tips us off to some very exciting things. I looked at this, these two seed pods. They really had emptied themselves. And I thought of old Hannah and Simeon. I thought of them, but I didn't write about them. I wrote about a business that was finished, and I wrote about a corporation that was done, and a season that was done, and a rush that was over, and a shop that was closed, and a counter that where the credit was closed, and bloom time and seed time was done. And I wrote about all this kind of thing that's true, not only in the autumn, but it's true because autumn doesn't happen only in September. So this tipped me off to all that which is true. And when you know that, you're in poetry, I think. You're in some very quick thinking. I'm going to read one. This is about Jacob. And these are, it's called sky traffic. And it's two weed seeds that and they're cropped at the top, which means you can't see the top or the bottom, which is neat because you can extend them as far as you want to. It means blocking it out just right. And when you crop it right, you can get as much prelude as you want and postlude as you want. It doesn't stop you. And I like that. I like the cropping of the picture sometimes helps you. Sometimes we see so much that we can't see anything. So you need to go around like this. So this was cropped. It's seed. I looked at this and I thought, powerful, marvelous. You put a little earth on it, a little water and a little sun, and that is going to, you can't stop it. You can stomp on it and it'll keep coming. It'll be powerful. It's like jet stream. That's what I wanted to write about. Skyward, earthward, and then I thought of Jacob. Skyward, earthward, move the multitudes. The runway is white hot with burnt fuel and thunderous with power. The pasture, now I thought, where this used to grow, they were pouring cement now. And they were pouring blacktop because we were getting ourselves ready for the great big airport. And I looked at the airport, I thought of the airport, I looked at Jacob, I thought of how does Jacob travel anymore? He doesn't travel on a donkey and not on foot. He gets with me on that airplane in the attaché case. And I was Jacob and all the other Jacobs going Northwest, Western Airline and so forth. I let all that come in. Angels ascend and descend and so do their people in the quiet pastures. Our public concrete and steel and the place of quiet seasons and sheep is replaced with tight schedules of flights day and night, cowbells silenced by horsepower of tens of thousands, and the whinny of young colts overcome by the revving of all engines at the fence rail. Red and green lights and yellow beacons blind the moon and the stars, and the tons of baggage and their people ascend and descend without walking. Side by side we sit, arranged neatly as in a fired bullet, and arch through the sky traffic. They sip tea and indulge in conversation and drink and eat and drink and read magazines and chase with red hot and white hot power through frigid weather while their coffee cools. The city has concrete pastures. Horses are obsolete and can be seen free at food fairs and touched and ridden while mother and father shop and ride the runways. The wildflowers cannot be found, but they are on sale in downtown hothouses, and mobile people riding the skyways converge in clusters of 100 and 200 and 1,000 outside the city limits and merge with haste into the city in cabs and hotels and tables reserved 60 days in advance. New Jacobs are on the move and they pound their stone pillows with prayers and aspirin and pills, and the God of Jacob is above every pillow and every motel neon and every bed, hard or soft. The God of Jacob waits on the men and the women who ascend and descend carrying lecture notes and attaché cases. New Jacobs who are able to pound stones into pillows, to beat cement back into green pastures, say with all Jacobs, the Lord was in this place and I did not know it. It's place. And for me, space puts me in touch with place, and sometimes I try to control that space because I know that controlling and confining myself in some way to a space is a discipline that helps that creative flow. Otherwise, I have a flood instead of a flow. And it's a discipline that I lay on myself, and I like it because it helps me corral some things from time to time. Jackson?
Okay. Well, I think I'll wind it up. I'll go back to Seward. When I was there, it came my turn to give chapel. And all the profs are supposed to give chapel. And I thought, well, I'll do something different. Down at Plum Creek Woods in the Little Blue River, the confluence of the two behind Concordia Teachers College in Seward, and it was November. And I thought, I'm going to do a thing about Jesus right here, not somewhere else, but right here in Seward, Nebraska, 68434. So I asked the office guy across from George, who taught 19th century and was a good chap. I said, George, you be Jesus, and I'll take pictures of you. He said, bully idea. George was always saying bully idea. He, no matter what you said, he liked it. Very easy guy to get along with that way. So we went to the drama department, and he pulled on a long burlap gown that he assumed looked Jesus robe type. And he had some thongs on, and he had already had a beard. So out we went. And of course, it never occurred to me that while I had my coat on and my gloves and poor George, skinny bare legs and thongs, and here it was November, and the ice had already frozen. He got a little cold. But I said, he said, what do you want me to do? And I said, well, just start running through the fields. And when you come to something, hop over it, and I'll just run right behind you and snap pictures. And I'm no photographer, but I borrowed a good camera and I started snapping. He got down to Plum Creek, which is frozen over, and he skidded out on that like Linus on the ice and fell down. I snapped that. And pretty soon, the farmer's big collie dog got into the act and started barking at Jesus and tugging at his robe, and I snapped that. And I just snapped, and we had a great time. And I got back to the school and had them developed. And I went to the library and picked out part of the Moldau and put that on tape and wrote an original kind of a script to go with it, and had one of my students, good old Andy, down there to run the projector. We got all set and we did it, and I was delighted. And 2 days later, a little note in my mailbox from the Dean of Chapel, the Dean of Students, who said, I'd like to see you in my office. And I thought, good, I'm going to receive some credit at last. What I received was an icy smile, which he reserved for those purposes, I found out. He said, about your chapel. I said, yes. He says, that was terrible. I said, it was. He said, yes. He said, the secretaries didn't understand it, smiling all the while. I said, the secretaries didn't understand it. I said, well, I didn't write it for the secretaries. I'm sorry they didn't understand it, and I'd like them to understand it, but that wasn't my intention for the secretaries particularly. He said, besides, there was no gospel message. And I said, no gospel message? I had 36 slides of Jesus Christ in Seward, Nebraska. Do I have to hold up a sign saying, this is gospel? This is Jesus. Isn't that gospel? And the smile, of course, never left his face. And I think he's still working for Jack Preuss down in St. Louis. So I better not tell you who he is. He's still smiling. I hope he's still smiling. He's a better man than I am that he can smile now. I'm glad he's in St. Louis and I'm in Holden. Well, at any rate, he said, if you'd like to redo it, we'll try it again. I said, no, thanks. I did it once the way I wanted to do it, I can't redo it. So we had kind of a parting of the ways, and he kept smiling. But I worried about that for a long time. It was the last chapel I gave. He didn't ask me to give another one. But it led to a poem, and it has a sense of place. So I thought I'd share that with you now. It's called Reflections of a Seward Chapel Talk. George had dressed as Jesus. I had my camera, and we went to Plum Creek Woods. George, or rather Jesus, jumped over logs, ran through thickets, beard flying, and rested on the ground exhausted. Jesus danced on the new ice in Plum Creek, slid about and waved his arms. I laughed and tried to catch it all, snapping pictures until the farmer's dog came up sniffing Jesus' robe. I snapped that too. Jesus pounding the big dog's chest and then running together down the hill with the late November sun catching at them, flashing through the barren trees. And softly falling down the hillsides, the purple Nebraska sky eddied among the logs, trees, and touched the ice and turned it blue. One last shot, George, I cried, and watched the endless sky leap into my lens with the solitary figure standing tall, tired, excited. This Jesus and I walked solely home to supper and talk. I showed my chapel slides, was told the secretaries didn't understand it, and further, said the Dean of Chapel, it's slightly pantheistic. All the slides are in a box somewhere beneath bathroom towels, I think. George left for the University of Florida. And I reflect now and again when I see the sky cover over and smell spice in the crisping air. I recall a young man pounding the ground with his strong legs, and I still see his breaking the ice and scooping the cold, clean water to drink, his eyes laughing, his teeth white. And I wink in my sleep at Jesus and see him in my mind's eye on Plum Creek, the wind blowing brown branches, and I hear the leaves dry rattle on the hill. And Jesus, his face hidden in the folds of his cloak, becomes a cave and merges with the purple sky until he is lost in the night. And he sends me sleep, purple, sliding down the hill, turning the ice blue.
Thank you. I ask Andy to come. Andy, Alex, you bring the chair here. This is when we, a poem is an arrangement, and a poetic moment is an arrangement. Andy? I met you a lot yesterday. I met you a lot yesterday. I met you a lot this week. Not just I, but I know I have. And Andy here. Andy plays harmonica. He's a plumber. You know what a plumber is. He fixes the bathroom, the pipes, and the...
You've seen him working.
And I asked you to play a song. And I'd like for these people to know that they were very near you when you played the song. It's called a seating arrangement. We do it all the time. We do it all the time. Do it at our tables. We do it in classrooms. Sometimes we do it by not doing it. The seating arrangement is random. We never kind of pull it together. Sometimes we could make a little celebration by saying that Andy's going to play you a song. But for us too, but especially. Sometimes there isn't especially. We even have students to whom we especially address something. Sometimes ask something. Especially. Especially for you. And also for all of us. And if it once you want it especially for yourself, kind of somehow find a way to move in. And we do that too. A song.
What one?
One of the two.
One of the two. Okay.
I ask Andy to bring two. Like that little stretch of highway. And whenever I come to Holden, one piece of a stretch of a highway, one road is, I look for Andy, and he's on that road. And you see the arrangement is that somehow if I asked you, Noah, where you were, do you know someone like that? Who does this to you? How does this feel? Then this is the refrain. If I'm writing a poem or an anthem, this is the refrain. Stanza one, stanza two, stanza three, the refrain. That's one way to visualize. A seating arrangement's not a bad deal. Neither is an arrangement of a flower garden or a bouquet or a meal or writing. An arrangement is really a way of putting together spatially some information. Makes a poem, makes poems more or less interesting, makes stories more or less long-living, makes lectures more or less understandable, but it's an arrangement, and that's spatial. It's a great gift. It's nothing new, is it? It's a very old subject. We didn't really need to meet. We didn't need to meet. We know what this night is about. It's something very near to us. Thank you. See you in town.